Hi, I'm Leonard, your speaker seeker in Santa Monica, California. And our speaker tonight is zooming in from his basement in Omaha, Nebraska. It gives me great pleasure to introduce you to Dee. Take it away, Dee. And you can speak until 8:25 Pacific time or 10:25 Central time.
Okay. If there is a timer, would you give me about a 5 minute notice, please? If I make it that far. Thanks again, Leonard, for inviting me to speak. My name is Dee, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Very, very important. It's nice that you have a speaker seeker, because that way you know who to blame. If you're not tickled pink when I'm done here tonight, just give me a chat in a few minutes in the chat, and I'll post Leonard's number so you can just give him all kinds of grief. It's very good. It's an honor to be here. It's always an honor to be asked to speak at an Al-Anon meeting, and in my case, it's a little bit of a surprise. I love seeing, I've got, I see some familiar faces. I used to attend this meeting. However, it is 9 o'clock in Nebraska, and I am very old. And the older you get, you eat dinner at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 7:30, you're starting to nod off. I know Jack has come to visit us a number of times, and we go to a 7:30 meeting, and that's really pushing it for us old guys. So I'm just grateful to be here and still awake. My story is I'm just a regular, typical Al-Anon. There's nothing really exciting about that about my story. I'm not one of those people who drowned their spouse, held them under until the bubbles quit coming up, and then resuscitated him. I've only been to jail overnight. I've been married four times so far. Successfully divorced three. I don't know if that's if you understand successfully divorced, but successfully divorced in my book is that I never paid a penny of child support and alimony. I had custody of the only two children that I ever fathered, and so I consider that a win. I was born in a small town in Indiana, North Central Indiana. The name was Akron, and between my sophomore and junior years, my parents divorced, and we moved to Omaha, Nebraska, where I've lived since 1961. When I came to Omaha, I got one of my first resentments. I didn't realize it was a resentment at the time. I didn't know what a resentment was until I did a four step. But I moved to Omaha, and I was a new kid in school, and everybody realized that I hadn't been there before. They would see me and they'd say, "Are you new?" And I, "Well, yeah." So, "Well, where are you from?" And I'd say Akron, Indiana. And they'd look at me and say, "Don't you mean Ohio?" Like I was so damn dumb, I didn't know where I came from. And so I started getting a resentment because people would question what I said. The home that I grew up in, I was the youngest of eight kids, and I rarely found myself in a position where I was right. I always had to fall in line, and I was at the end of the line. I didn't like that. And early on in my life, I realized that there were only two things that were really important to me. Number one is to get my way. I would do anything to get my way. I would lie. I would cheat. I would knock somebody out of the way, but I wanted my way. And the other thing was to be right. It was very, very important for me to be right. Now, the home I grew up in was not an alcoholic home. My parents were angry at each other all the time. In addition to the 8 children my mother bore, she had 3 miscarriages. That's 11 pregnancies. And I could not imagine 2 people who screamed at each other like my mother and father did, having the kind of relationship that would create 11 pregnancies. I didn't enjoy living in that house. As I said, there wasn't alcohol. There was a lot of rage. I'm not sure that some alcohol wouldn't have helped, but that would have just gotten me started on my journey a little earlier. After we moved here to Omaha, there were more people in the class that I was in the high school here in Omaha than there were in the entire 12 grades of the school that in the town that I came from. There were more people in the high school. There were twice as many people in the high school as there was in the town that I came from. I was experiencing a little culture shock. I had a very difficult time making friends. There was a small group of us, and we were fairly close. We were part of the ROTC group. And one night we were out after school. This was in our senior year, late in our senior year. And I had never considered what I wanted to do if I grew up. That is something that at age 76, I still haven't considered. And I still don't know what the answer to that question is. I don't know what I want to be if I grow up. I know I'm living part of it right now. I'm retired. I don't have a job to go to. There's pretty much nothing that I am required to do. So I am enjoying that part of my life. However, the 4 or 5 of us, there were 5 of us in the group. We were down in a part of Omaha, South Omaha, and it was a part where the packing houses were. And we were walking down 24th Street one night, and there was a guy outside the post office. They had a little trailer out there. He had a real nice looking suit. I figured out later he was a salesman, was what he was. That wasn't the title he had, but I liked that suit. And me and 3 of those other guys, 4 of the 5 of us, signed up, and we went into the Marine Corps. They didn't give me one of those suits. They didn't put me in a trailer outside the Omaha post office. They sent me off to San Diego to boot camp, and I got there, and those folks just didn't treat me right. They used bad language, and they used it at me directly. I tried to explain to them that some of the things they said weren't true. I told them that my parents had been married for 18 years when I was born. They didn't care. They had a term for me that they used anyway. And they alluded to a relationship with my mother that I knew I had never had. And I just generally didn't like it. I didn't understand it until I did a 4-step many years later that right away I knew I wanted out of there. And that was a trend that was to follow me all of my life. And sometimes can today. It's always the next thing that's going to make me happy. It's always something out there, outside of me, that is going to take care of me or take care of my feelings and fill like God-sized hole that I have in my gut. I don't know why that hole is there. I don't know where it came from, but it's there, and I need to fill it with something. Fast forward a few years, you know, I did get out of there. Much to many people's surprise, I received an honorable discharge. Got out of there, and I went to work for the government in a civil service position. I worked for the post office, and I have to tell you that when I tell people that I was in the Marine Corps and I worked for the post office, they usually take a step back because they assume a lot of things about me that just really aren't true. After I had gotten out of the Marine Corps and gone to work for the post office, I got an apartment with a buddy, we had this apartment, and he gave me one of my second resentments. I say one of my seconds because I was starting to collect them pretty fast at that time. I was out living on my own. I had moved out from my family. He caused me to have a resentment, and it was definitely his fault. Of course, all my resentments are somebody else's fault, which leads us to the pre-Al-Anon slogan that I think I found is true for other people, but it certainly was true for me, and that is happiness is knowing who to blame. After I started my journey in recovery, I did decide that if I found out who it was to blame and I could get next to them and straighten them out, then my life would be okay. However, my roommate, the resentment he gave me was the fact that he married my girlfriend. I thought that was kind of a cheap shot. Turned out later, he turned himself in as an alcoholic. And so possibility that he saved me from a relationship with an untreated Al-Anon. And so I maybe dodged a bullet there, and I've been able to forgive him for that and there let go of that resentment. Subsequently, another thing that I found out, having done a four step, was that I don't do well alone. I don't like to be alone. I don't particularly like to be around large groups of people, but I just don't like to live alone and not have some kind of a partner or somebody close to me in my life. And so not too long after my roommate married my girlfriend, a buddy of mine from the Marine Corps came through town, and he knew a girl. He introduced me to her, and I married her. And she and I had two children together. We were married about 4 years. It didn't work out, and that was not because of her. Most of the, I'll share at least 50% of the blame in that, because there's no way that any kind of a relationship goes bad because of one person. I like to blame her. I like to think it was her fault, but she and I divorced, and I had custody of two girls. They were 1.5 and 2.5 at the time that we got divorced. The little one was not even housebroken yet. And so I got to experience all the things that you get to experience when you have a child, changing diapers, getting up in the middle of the night, doing all that stuff. That doesn't make me a hero. That makes me the one that the judge considered less dangerous for the kids. I subsequently, under the guise and using the children to blame, so they could have a mother, I married two other women. You can't marry somebody for the wrong reason. Companionship is not a reason to get married. It must be that you desire a relationship with a person and that you want to spend your life with them. And I didn't know that then. I only was looking for my own selfish needs. I wanted somebody to help me raise the kids. And that's why I married those women. And I inflicted some damage on the kids, taking them through that stuff. After my third divorce, I had done some work in my workplace with a labor union. And I became an official in that union. I spent quite a bit of time in the union office. And we had a secretary in there. She was a real nice gal. I had known her for quite a while. I'd known her husband for a number of years. And they were just really good people. Every once in a while, I was the vice president of the union. I would take the union president's place. Frequently, he would just call me at home and he'd say, "Hey, I had a couple of beers after work last night, and I don't feel like going into the office today. Could you get some time off and go down and take over?" So I would do that. And usually what would end up with it, it was rarely a one-day thing. It was usually three or four. at any rate, the secretary was such a sweet lady, and I would come out of my office and into hers to see if she could help with something. And she'd be reading this little blue book, and she would just close it, put it in her desk drawer, and put it away. Finally, one day I asked her what it was, and she said, well, it's called One Day at a Time, and it has readings in there that help me learn how to live. And what I found out was that her husband had gone into treatment. He was a man who was in the Air Force, and he got in trouble in his job. He had a very good job in the Air Force, and he was getting close to retirement. He was afraid he'd lose retirement, so he had to go through treatment. He got to go to outpatient treatment, and she was going to something called Al-Anon. Now, I had not gotten the concept that alcoholism was a disease. I didn't know anything about it. I had barely heard of AA. I knew a few people that went. It always seemed to me like they were going to get out of trouble. And I'd never heard of Al-Anon. I didn't know what that was. And she explained to me very gently that it was a fellowship. And I didn't understand what that was. So I just before the meeting, I looked it up in my online dictionary here, and it says a friendly association, especially with people who share one's interests. A group of people meeting to pursue a shared interest or aim, or a guild or corporation. People with a mutual interest in looking to solve a common problem. That's the definition we use. And I think that describes it very, very well. It explains it to me in terms that a retired postal supervisor can understand. It's very important that you use, when you're talking to me, you use short sentences and small words. I didn't know that I was about to embark on an adventure that would last me a lifetime. But this lady had a friend who would come up and visit her, and they would go to lunch, and I found that lady very attractive. I was very leery about having been divorced three times. I thought there was something wrong with me. I thought I was damaged goods. I thought there was something perhaps even genetically wrong, that I was destined not to be married. But that woman was attractive to me in a way that I hadn't experienced until that time. So I asked the secretary if she would check with the lady and see if it was okay if she gave me her phone number. And it was a positive. And so I started asking her out. And she was never available. She was always going to some meeting or other meeting and one thing and another, and just never had time to go out with me. Finally, I asked her out one weekend, and she said, no, I'm going to the Cornhusker Roundup. Now, I didn't know what that was. I had no idea. I thought it was like a rodeo. And I asked her if I could go with her. So I decided that, I would go with her to this thing. And my primary reason for going was that I wanted to see how they handled horse manure at the Holiday Inn, because I thought, again, we were going to see bucking broncos and bull riding and that kind of thing. And turns out it was a gathering of alcoholics. And there were about, at that time, there were about 2,500 people there. And that was back in the good old days. I went to my first meeting there at the Cornhusker Roundup on the 19th day of August in 1983. It was a Friday night. And when I say it was a good old days, it was back in the days where you had real coffee cups. They didn't there. They actually had styrofoam cups there, but you could smoke in the room. And I knew there were speakers up there, but because I could hear them, but I couldn't really see them. And if you left there without your eyes burning, there was something seriously wrong with you. At any rate, I went there, and the first thing they did was they read 12 of something and 12 of something else. I wasn't paying too much attention because I was really there to be with her. And I didn't understand a lot of what was going on, but this guy got up and he told some of the most disgusting details of his life. And I thought, my God, what human being would ever do that? Nobody in his right mind. And I believe that right up to this minute. that people that do that are just maybe we're a little off. Anyway, Jack is laughing and smiling because he knows that he's in that group too. At any rate, after this guy got done telling his story, they introduced his wife and she told the truth about what had happened. You know, he told a version, but she told the truth. I just knew that was the way it was. And that was my introduction to AA and Al-Anon. That was the first time I had ever been to a meeting of either one. And so we went to the second night. And then on Sunday morning, they had a speaker. I didn't like to do things on Sunday morning because I had become anti-God and anti-church. And I just had the feeling that if you left the house on Sunday morning, it was a religious occasion. And I didn't want anything to do with that, but I went anyway. And I really found out I enjoyed that lady's company. So if anybody tells you that you didn't get here right, all you have to do is tell them that you know somebody that came to Al-Anon on a date. Never let it be said that I don't know how to show a girl a good time. At any rate, I wanted to spend more time with her. And frankly, I was going to Al-Anon to spend time with her. I wasn't going to Al-Anon. I didn't even have a problem. I knew that there was no, you know, I would go to meetings. I would go to meetings and they would talk about my alcoholic. Today we hear my qualifier. I have to say this, I am my own qualifier. I'm not here because of anybody else. I'm here because of me. I'm the one that has the problem. And I'm not able to solve anybody else's problem, nor do I want to today. But they talked about my alcoholic like it was a pet. And I didn't have one. I was sure I didn't have one. There wasn't one in my home, and all the rest of them had one. They either had a spouse or a kid or a drunken mother-in-law or their father or their brother, somebody. I didn't have any of that. There were no alcoholics in my family, in my immediate family. I was a little suspicious about two of the women that I had been married to. I knew they had something wrong. If nothing else, they had bad taste in men. But I have to say that the fact that when they drank, they had at the very least short-term memory loss. They forgot things like, where did they live? Who did I think they were supposed to sleep with? Little information like that. And again, I thought that was about me. And as it turns out, it didn't have anything to do with me. It was all about them. And what one of the most instructive things that I've heard in Al-Anon is live and let live. There are some things I don't have to put up with unacceptable behavior, but I need to let other people live their life, and I need to work on living mine. At any rate, I kept being dragged around to meetings, and after about 3 or 4 months, I was outside what I considered my home group. I picked that group because everybody else had a home group, and I knew that you were supposed to have one. And I was outside this home group, and there were about 3 or 4 people around. There was this one old grizzled guy who'd wear cowboy boots and a cowboy hat. The lady that was the secretary at the union office, my friend that I had fallen deeply in lust with. And I was standing there and I was overcome with this moment of truth. And I just had to share my truth. My sponsor later told me, I didn't have a sponsor at that time, but the guy who was to become my sponsor was there. He was the old cowboy. And I said, you know, I understand how those poor people feel in there. And I understand their problems, and I'm really sorry for them. But I don't have that kind of problems. I don't have an alcoholic. Oh boy, I should have kept my mouth shut that night. You know, I've learned since then that silence is golden and duct tape is silver. And my current sponsor sent me a roll of duct tape just after he agreed to be my sponsor. They took off on me. like an F4B. Man, I've got to tell you, they came after me. They said, well, what about this person and this person and this person? See, I hadn't had sense enough to keep my mouth shut in the meetings. And so I would tell them stories about the people in my life and this one and that one. And what about the union president? And what about your first wife? And what about your third wife? And what about this other person that, oh my God. So I said, okay. You know, I'll just keep coming back. I'll probably be able to help you all sooner or later. So I kept coming back. I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't working the steps. I was in a meeting one night and it seemed like I always ended up in these meetings about the spiritual part of the program. For the newcomers, I want you to know that there is no spiritual part of the program. It is a spiritual program. It's the whole thing. And so they told, I would end up in these meetings and they would talk about God and your higher power. And I would just, I don't know how I kept ending up in those things. And finally, one night I was waxing eloquently about the lack of God, about the lack of my relationship with him, and that I was never going to get Al-Anon because I just didn't have the God thing going for me. And this old guy across the table looked at me and he said, young fella, I'm going to tell you what I heard a speaker say. There's only two things you need to know about God, and that's that there is one, and it ain't you. Holy, I thought, well, you obnoxious old fart. What the heck? And he seemed to think that was okay. And I looked around the room and there were a lot of people nodding and smiling. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to keep quiet meetings from now on. I'm not going to help these people. So, it just went on and on. And after that, I ended up in meetings about sponsorship. Have a sponsor. What does your sponsor say? What did you do? You know, my sponsor told me, you know, I hear all that crap and I didn't have a sponsor. So one night I just got overcome as I was leaving a meeting and there was this guy ahead of me, had on the cowboy boots and a hat. And I reached out and I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, hey, turned around and it was him. It was a guy that told me there is one and it ain't you. And I thought, I said, hey, would you be my sponsor? And he tried every way he could to get out. He said, do you have a sponsor now? Do you call him? Do you? I said, nope, never had one. Never asked anybody. You're the first one. He said, okay, we'll try it. We'll try it temporarily and see how it works out. Well, we tried it temporarily for 11 years. Then he retired, moved away, and died. And his name was Leo Stanky. And I learned more from that man than I ever realized I was learning. He kept nagging at me and bitching at me to work the steps. I didn't want to work the steps. I was sure they didn't apply to me. I was still trying to disqualify myself because I didn't have my alcoholic. I had all these other people on the periphery of my life, but I never had anybody right in the center, or so I thought. And that's when I began to understand the idea that I wasn't there because of an alcoholic. I was there because of my behavior, my thoughts, my actions, and my life. I got sick and tired of hearing him complain at me about the steps. And I finally said, okay, I'm going to work the steps, but I only have one purpose in mind. I'm going to prove to you that they don't apply to me. And when you see what a wretched failure I am at doing these steps, you will understand and leave me alone about it. And I did tell him that I thought 12 was an awful lot. And he said, well, since it's you and you're so special, we'll break them down into four groups for you. We'll make the first ones about giving up. The next bunch will be about owning up. After that, we'll get into making up. And then we'll do growing up. And so we went to work on the first three steps. And I had a very difficult time right after I got past the first one. You know, I did have a little bit of trouble admitting I was powerless and that my life was unmanageable because I had had some successes at some things in my life. And those were the only things I looked at. I never looked at the failures. I never looked at the things that were going wrong. And I know today that you shouldn't look at those. You shouldn't look at only the things that are wrong. You shouldn't also only look at the things that are right. But you need to be aware of where you are and where you're going. There's a reason that when you're in an automobile, the windows on either side of you and the windshield are big and the rearview mirror is small, because it's very important to look about where you are and where you're going rather than where you've been. The only reason the past has in our lives is to make us, to give us lessons for the things that we have done that we can learn from. That is the past. It is to be our teacher. Difficult time with the first three steps. That third one was really tough, but as it turns out, it's the cornerstone of recovery. As far as I'm concerned, the third step is the building block on which you can build your recovery. And I have to remember that I am an Al-Anon to get recovery, not relief. I'm here to change my life, improve my life, and to be a maximum service to God. So we got past the third step, and I put on the brakes there in a big hurry. It was very difficult for me. I didn't want to do a fourth step. I wasn't sure the statute of limitations had run out on a couple of things, and so I wasn't willing to write anything down and be spouting off about it until I was darn good and ready. And one year for Christmas, my sponsor gave me a pen and pencil set. He was not the master of subtlety. I took the hint, and I did do a fourth step. I did as searching and fearless an inventory as I could at the time. I'm not sure how moral it was, because I was pretty hard on myself. There were some things that I had to do, that I had to talk about that I didn't want to talk about. And when I came time to do my fifth step, and this is, I found out that this is something that I have in common with a lot of people, is that my sponsor sat me down in his basement. He put me in a straight back chair as he raised the foot rest on his recliner, and I was in a straight back wooden chair. And he said, "Okay, on the way over here, there was one thing that you had decided not to tell me. You probably haven't written down, and that's the only thing I want to hear." And I thought, how did this old bastard know that? I thought, what in the world? And he could tell. I mean, I just about fell out of that chair. And so there was one thing. And I told him about it. And he said, "Okay, what about the rest of this stuff you've written down here? What do you need to tell me about that?" And it was a lot easier to do the rest of it that I had written down after I told him that one thing. On the way over there, I was correcting that. I was, you know, they didn't have texting back then, but I was looking at the thing, and, you know, it's a wonder I didn't run into a train or something, because I was trying to read that thing, and I was mentally correcting the punctuation and a couple of spelling words and all that kind of stuff. But I got through that fourth step and fifth step. And I felt like a different person. I felt like for the first time in Al-Anon, I belonged. The thing that really cemented it was steps six and seven. I got to tell you, step six is the most difficult one for me to work. Step six is being entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And step seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I want you to be in a meeting sometime, in a step six meeting or a step seven meeting, and see how many people talk about the other step. It's interesting that I have to work on the step that I'm on. And in those two steps, I found a great deal of forgiveness. I have never had a shortage of people in my life that are willing to point out things that I am doing wrong, or that I have done wrong, and that I need to correct. And some people were willing to tell me how to correct them, and they were willing to tell me where to go if I didn't correct them. But one of the things, or the most important takeaway that I have from those two steps is, number one, step six says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. At the point I was trying to work step six, I was in the middle of developing a relationship with a power greater than me that was a loving higher power. He was not the gimme gotcha God. He was neither Santa Claus nor a terrorist, but he was a loving God who cared for me. And what I discovered there was that I was trying to do God's work. When I was trying to correct those things, I was not asking for God's help. And step seven tells me to do that. I have to humbly ask him. And I didn't understand humility. I always carried the definition that I've heard other people talk about in meetings. I was living with humiliation. And humiliation is something that you can only do to yourself. Other people can give you fuel for that humiliation, but to take that on and to beat yourself with it is all up to you. And in order to humble it, I've heard a lot of definitions of humility. One of my favorites is that it's not thinking less of yourself, it's just thinking of yourself less. And being teachable. That was one of the things. You know, I came into Al-Anon and I knew everything. And I found today I wake up, and in the morning when I wake up, I realize that I don't know anything. I have no idea what's going to happen. One of my first things when I wake up is I ask God to get in my head before I do. Having worked steps six and seven, my sponsor referred again to the pen and pencil set. And he said, we need to make a list of all the persons you have harmed. I want to tell just a little bit of my wife's story here. By the way, I'm plan B because my wife and I were supposed to share this time tonight. However, she got very sick and she's not doing well, but she's able to sit up and take nourishment now. So we're grateful for that. But I want to tell you a part of her story. She said when she went to make her step eight list, her sponsor, she said to her sponsor, well, I never really hurt anybody. I just tried to help people. And her sponsor told her, okay, put down all the people that you helped. And that way we'll work with that. You know, I didn't think I had hurt anybody. I thought a lot of people had hurt me, but my sponsor had told me to keep my fourth step. And so we got back into that fourth step and we started finding a great number of people in there to go on my eight step list. One question I had for him about that, I said, what about people that harm me? And he said, oh, you're still working on learning who it is that has the problem here. He said, it is never, ever, ever, ever going to be about them. This is about you. This is people that you need to go to. And so then, wow, what a deal. So I had to become willing. That's the hardest part of that step. You know, I can put names down all day. I can put names down till the cows come home. But to become willing to go to them and amend what I have done, to correct the wrongs that I did for them, to repay them if I stole from them, to give back things of theirs that I took, to do whatever it is to make my life right so that I can go forward. To do that in step nine, to become willing to do that is one of the most difficult parts of the program for me. After having done steps eight and all of nine that I could do at the time, I was pretty sure that I was ready for sainthood because steps five through nine were a painful process for me. And so I was just really sure that that people would be driving by my house and they would say, oh, that's where he lives. There, oh my God, is that him on the front porch? Oh, however, that was not to be it. My sponsor said step 10 is going to be very instrumental in your day-to-day recovery, and I didn't understand that. And he led me to believe that I was going to have to do something that was akin to doing the first nine steps every day. And so I had to do, what I had to do was continue to take personal inventory. Oh, and by the way, he pointed out to me, this needs to be your inventory you're taking, not other people's. Wow. What an order. And so I had to start doing that. And what I find out is it's the thing that keeps me current. It's the thing that keeps me from having to go back and do those first nine steps over and over and over. It's the thing that keeps me in today and prepares me for tomorrow. Step 10, step 11 is beautiful for me today. I want to improve the relationship with my higher power that I have. And the only way I know how to do it is through prayer and meditation. I have to talk to God and I have to listen for his voice. And that is a very satisfying and wonderful thing for me to do today. And step 12, you know, when we get into step 12 meetings, a lot of times we only hear about the part about carrying the message. And that's the least part of step 12 for me today. I was very disappointed to find out that the only thing I got, and if you listen closely when the steps are read, having had a spiritual awakening as the, I think that word should be capitalized in bold print and underlined. The result of working the steps is a spiritual awakening. And so what I get is a closer relationship with my higher power, and that's the greatest gift that all of you have given me. And we tried to carry this message to others and practice these principles in all our affairs. We tried. We're not ever going to do it perfect because we're human. The thing that the 12 steps did for me was they prepared me to live my life. They prepared me to take me through the loss of all my brothers and sisters. I'm the only one in the family left. One of the sadnesses in my life is that my parents, neither one was alive when I came into recovery, and they cannot see the person that I have become today. Life continues to happen in Al-Anon, and what it has done for me, what Al-Anon has done for me, is it enabled me to live life on life's terms and not on D's terms. I no longer have to get my way, and I don't have to be right. 2018 was a horrible year for our family. We had a young son-in-law that died. I had my younger daughter became a widow with three children to raise and was floundering wildly for a while, but has righted herself and is doing very well. Her sister was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. We went through that. We went through two operations. We went through chemo. We didn't go through it. I didn't lose my hair, but by God, it was devastating to see her go through the things that she had to do. My wife's beloved brother died. He was a fellow Marine. He and I were in the Marine Corps at about the same time. We shared that common experience. He was just a great guy. I've never met anybody that didn't like him. Thank you. And you know, he died, and we got out of 2018 and thought, wow, that's over. We're really really on the road of happy destiny now. We're gonna just trudge along. And in January of 2019, my wife's sister died. Within 6 months, she lost her entire family. And so we got to put our Al-Anon tools to work with that. We've also had a lot of joy. We have 15 grandkids. The youngest ones are seniors in high school and will graduate this year. In a couple of weeks, we're going to be going to Amana, Iowa, to celebrate the wedding of our second oldest granddaughter. Life is full of good things and bad things, and we're able to live through the day-to-day things that life throws at us. It's been a blessing. It's been a blessing. I'd be neglectful if I didn't mention my wife of 33 years. That's my personal best by far. You know, I had been married to Carol for a few years before I got to 10 years total. And that was adding them all up. And I've been married to this wonderful woman, and there are some of you here that know her. I've been married to her for 33 years. And we've had bad times, but we've had way, way, way more great times. Our life is full today, and it's because of the blessings of Al-Anon and that spiritual awakening that it talks about in step 12. Our higher power has blessed us. I'm going to talk about myself now. My higher power has blessed me far beyond anything I could have ever imagined when I came into Al-Anon, not even needing it. I do have to tell you that I am not married to the woman that took me to my first meeting. She married an alcoholic who was a friend of mine. And Skip sadly passed away a couple of months ago. But Carol and I, as I said, have been married for 33 years. And my life has been unbelievable. I have friends literally all over the world now, thanks to Zoom. And I am so grateful to be here. As our British friends say, I'll leave it there. And thank you all. I do want to, let me take just a minute to welcome the newcomers. We had, at the beginning of the meeting here, we celebrated birthdays that came up to a total, I believe, of 136 years. That's a lot of time. We have one lady here that's 41 years. That's a long time. I know when I was young in the program and they had people that had 10 or 12 years, I sometimes thought, how come it takes them so long to get it? Well, I'm one of those people that is not in the gifted and talented group. I keep coming back because I need this and I want what all of you have. I want recovery. I want the fellowship and I want a better relationship with my higher power. That's it for me. Thank you very much for inviting me to share.